Morning. On February 25th, 1991, during the Persian Gulf War, a Scud missile was launched at an American Army barrack in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. This particular barrack was equipped with a Patriot missile system, which was able to destroy the Scud missile mid-flight before it reached its target. However, the Patriot missile system was never launched, and the Scud struck the base, killing 28 soldiers and injuring about 100 other individuals. This one single event accounted for more than a third of the American deaths during this conflict. So what happened? Why didn't we pull the trigger? Why didn't we shoot down this Scud missile? Well, the defense system for this base, which also included the Patriot missile system, had a problem. The defense system for the base had an internal clock which was rounding a very, very small number, which was used to calculate time. Specifically, the system used a calculation to determine each 1/10 of a second. Now, that number should have been the first number that's written up here on the board. I don't know how to say that number. Maybe some of our kids in school know. But what was happening was that the system was truncating the number. It was rounding the number to the second number that you see up there. And this was a very small, but what found out to be a very significant difference. And by small, it took me a minute, but I figured out that the system was off by 1/septillionth. Of a second. I don't really understand what a billion is, and we talk about a billion a lot, so I'm not sure I can really grasp the concept of 1/septillionth of a second, except to say it's the number in red, which is a whole bunch of zeros followed by a couple of ones, two more zeros, and another one. So a very little number, and yet a very big problem, because every tenth of a second, the rounding error got bigger. And so long as the system was rebooted, the error never became large enough for the operators to notice that something was wrong. On February 25th, 1991, the system had been operating for about 100 hours since the last time it was rebooted at the time of the Scud missile launch. By this time, the error had multiplied 3.6 million times, and the system was off by a whopping 0.3 seconds, about a third of a second off. The radar system that had successfully detected the Scud missile upon launch had predicted where to look for it in the sky next. And when it looked, because of this timing error, it looked in the wrong part of the sky and found no missile. And so because of this, it was determined that it was an error, and the missile was removed from the system. No intercept attempt was made, and the Scud missile hit its target. Even after 100 hours, the system was only off by 3/10 of a second. It was almost accurate, but yet it wasn't. The word almost is a term that completely changes the sentence and in a lot of ways negates the action. The word almost is often used to soften the reality of a situation, but the particular truth that is almost is not much that different from not at all. Think about it. I almost hit a home run. I mean, I didn't really hit a home run, but I almost hit a home run. I almost ran over my dog. We almost got into a wreck. I was so sick, I almost died. See, almost is not at all, is it? This morning we're going to talk about almost. The Bible talks a little bit about almost, about things that almost happened. And the first thing that we're going to talk about is a man named Hadad. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, we read the brief statement about David and the nation of Edom. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 14, he being David, he also put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom, he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. Now, if this was the only passage about these events in David's reign, I don't know that we would think much of this. We might think that David made some sort of deal with Edom, that he would be able to put an army there. I mean, you know, look what we did in Saudi Arabia, right? We made a deal with them. We put our own military bases there. We do that quite a bit. Maybe that's what's happened here. If all we knew was what's recorded here in 2 Samuel chapter 8, we might think this is a peaceful process. But after David dies, we find out more in 1 Kings chapter 11. See, David and Joab had been fighting with the Edomites, and David was out to annihilate the Edomites. And after David returned to Israel, he left Joab there for 6 months with the explicit command to kill every male Edomite. And Joab got it done. Well, Joab almost got it done. If you're going to turn with me, we're going to look at 1 Kings chapter 11. We're going to read verses 14 through 22. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 14. Now the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was a descendant of the king of Edom. For it happened when David was in Edom, and Joab, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the slain after he had killed every male in Edom, because for 6 months Joab remained there with all Israel until he had cut down every male in Edom. But Hadad fled to go to Egypt, he and certain Edomites of his father's servants with him. Hadad was still a little child. Then they rose from Midian and came to Paran, and they took men with them from Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave him a house, apportioned food for him, and gave him land. And Hadad found great favor in the sight of Pharaoh, so that he gave him as wife the sister of his own wife, that is, the sister of Queen Tapenes. Then the sister of Tapenes bore him Jenobath, his son, whom Tapenes weaned in Pharaoh's house. And Jenobath was in Pharaoh's household among the sons of Pharaoh. So when Hadad heard in Egypt that David rested with his fathers, and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me depart, that I may go to my own country." Then Pharaoh said to him, "What have you lacked with me, that suddenly you seek to go to your own country?" So he answered, "Nothing, but let me go away." I don't think Hadad just wanted to go home, because he didn't go to his own country. He didn't go to Edom. What we find in verse 25 is that Hadad created trouble for Solomon. Now, we don't really know. The Bible doesn't tell us what kind of trouble Hadad created for Solomon. But the context seems to make us think that Hadad may have been one of these leaders of raiders who were tormenting Solomon and the children of Israel. Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 15, and we'll read about another man. Or we'll read about a situation that another man comes from. 1 Samuel chapter 15, God commands Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. And Saul does most of the job, but you remember he spares a few of the choice animals, and he spares King Agag. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 9, "But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the ox and the fatling and the lambs and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them, but everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed." You remember what happens next. God sends Samuel to Saul to rebuke him for not following his instructions. You see, Saul almost got it right, but not quite. Even though we could comment on the specific shortcomings, it's not the point of what I want to make here. When Samuel arrives, he rebukes Saul for not killing the animals. And there's a well-known statement in the Old Testament in verse 22, where we're told, "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice." Samuel then, if you remember, also takes care of King Agag. verse 32 and 33. Then Samuel said, "Bring Agag, king of the Amalekites, here to me." So Agag came to him cautiously, and Agag said, "Surely the bitterness of death is past." But Samuel says, "As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women." And Samuel hacked Agag into pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. The end of the Amalekites, right? Nope, not the end of the Amalekites. Even the death of Agag, Saul still only did part of the job. Fast forward to Esther chapter 3 and verse 1, and we read about the man Haman, the Agagite. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. An Agagite. Huh. How is that even possible? Here it is, some 550 years after Saul had nearly wiped out the Amalekites, that the children of Israel were at risk again of annihilation at the hands of an Amalekite. An Amalekite who identifies himself as a descendant of Agag. Because you remember how the rest of the story goes. Haman convinced the king to sign a law that would destroy all of the Jews. And so here we have two stories of two men who should have never existed because somebody did almost everything they were asked to do. They only came to be because someone almost destroyed their people. Almost. You know, what are we supposed to make of that? Well, I think the most natural connection here is for us to think of these things in terms of our own lives and in relationship to sin. Have you completely removed sin from your life? And I don't mean all sin. I want you to think about a specific sin, a particular sin. Is it completely gone or is it almost gone? Because the almost is like Haman, not good enough. Just like Haman and Hadad. If you leave a remnant of sin in your life, it will come back to bite you. The Bible talks a lot about this, but I want to focus on Matthew chapter 12, verse 43 through 45, because I think there's some interesting things to draw from this. Jesus here teaches, when an unclean spirit goes out from a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest and finds none. Then he says, "I will return to my house from which I came." And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then he comes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there, and the last state of the man is worse than the first. So shall it also be with this wicked generation. What is Jesus talking about here? Is Jesus talking about demon possession? Well, I mean, yes, he is. But what are we supposed to make of that? We know that there was a finite time when God allowed the servants of Satan to possess people, and that time has passed. So what are we supposed to make of this? Well, that unclean spirit, I think, is talking about sin. And here Jesus teaches us that when we take sin out of our lives, if we don't replace it with something, if we don't get rid of it completely, if we just kind of get rid of it, it's going to come back. And it's going to come back worse than what it was before. And I bet each one of us can think of situations in our own lives where those things have happened. Consider for a minute recidivism statistics. That was a hard word for me to say. Recidivism, it's a word that we don't maybe say all that much. But this is reincarceration of people who have been released from prison. There was a study done in 1994 that looked at 15 states, and of the nearly 300,000 prisoners who were released, about 67% of them were rearrested and back in prison within 3 years. Fast forward to 2012, which was the most recent data I could find, This time looking at 34 states, the Bureau of Justice Statistics shows that the recidivism rate had increased to 75%. 75% in this study of people who had been released from prison were rearrested within 5 years. And what's interesting is that this study also points out that one-third of former prisoners were unable to find work after being released. So what do you think is going on there? Well, it's just like what Jesus said. They had been released from prison. They couldn't find work. There may be other things at play here, I'm sure, but they just went back to what they had been doing before because they didn't fill their time with anything else. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 11 describes it this way. As a dog returns to his own vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. And about every one of us who's owned a dog has watched exactly what Solomon is writing there. And you just watch in disgust as your dog goes and eats its own vomit. But that's what God looks like. That's what we look like to God when we return to our own sins. Paul describes sin as yeast twice. Once in Galatians and once in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 6. And it's here he says, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Now he's talking about the church there at Corinth that had some people who were sinning that they didn't take care of. And the point Paul was making is that those people who are sinning, that one who is sinning and you're not taking care of it, they're corrupting the whole church. And I would assert to say that sin in our lives does the same thing. Just a little bit of sin is just like a little bit of yeast. It leavens the whole lump. That's the comparison the Bible makes. I like to think of sin as cancer. I think maybe some of my background. But your body is made up of something like 50 trillion cells, all working together in a prescribed fashion that makes your body work. Our body is the number one example of the existence of God, the intricacies of how our bodies work. And yet cancer literally begins as a single cell that for whatever reason starts doing its own thing and ultimately becomes selfish. That cancer cell starts to live, grow uncontrollably. It steals nutrients. It eventually starts to spread. And left unchecked, it will kill the person, even killing itself in the process. One cell out of 50 trillion is ultimately enough to kill you. Hadad, Haman, and sin are like one cancer cell that's left over after surgery. The procedure was almost successful. It was almost complete. You're almost cured. But in the end, almost is enough to kill you. And even though I think of sin as easily comparable to cancer, that's not what the Bible uses cancer to describe. We talked about this morning. I think it's interesting. Cancer is mentioned only one time in the Bible, and it's compared to false teaching. And it's a passage that we studied this morning in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 17 and 18. And here it's talking about the false teaching that of two men. And here's the thing to point out here. We can be almost right in doctrine, can't we? And still be completely wrong. In 2 Timothy 2, 17 and 18, Paul confronts Hymenaeus and Philetus about teaching a doctrine about the resurrection of the dead. They were teaching that the resurrection had already passed, and this was erring from the truth, and it was causing some people's faith to be overthrown. Paul said this doctrine was spreading like a cancer. It was growth, but it wasn't good growth in any way. These men were almost right, but in the end, they were totally wrong. And you see, false teaching is just like that, isn't it? False teaching is a lot of truth and a little bit of lie. You remember how Satan deceived Eve by almost telling the truth? He changed one little thing about what God said. Genesis chapter 3, verse 4, then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. What's the difference there? Well, the difference is the word not. An awful lot like almost, isn't it? Right? It changes the context entirely. God said, if you eat of this tree, you will die. And Satan's like, if you eat of this tree, you're not going to die. Right? He took a little bit of truth, took a lot of truth, added a little bit of lie, and changed the meaning entirely. Because false teaching is almost true, it's altogether dangerous. Henry Ward Beecher said it this way: whatever is only almost true is quite false, and among the most dangerous of errors, because being so near truth, it is the more likely to lead astray. There are dozens of examples of people in the Bible who followed the instructions of God almost. Nadab and Abihu in Numbers chapter 10. They got everything right in their service to God except for one detail. They offered strange fire to God. The rich young ruler in Matthew chapter 19. He kept all of the commandments of the law except that he could not part with his possessions. Jeroboam in 2 Kings chapter 15 verse 3 and 4 it reads this: and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. So this is Jeroboam, the second Jeroboam, right? And I wish I could just stop by reading verse 3. But verse 4 begins with, except that the high places were not removed, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Solomon served God, except he loved foreign women. Saul killed almost everyone except for Agag and apparently some other people too. You remember that Scud missile? It's a pretty sad reality, because when you hear the rest of the story, it makes it even worse. At the time of the attack, the Israelis had already identified that there was a problem that led to this calculation error. And they had already informed the United States Army and the software manufacturer 2 weeks prior to the attack. And no upgrade was made. As a stopgap measure, the Israelis recommended that the system be rebooted regularly, essentially daily. However, Army officials did not understand how often they needed to do this. And so on February 26, 1991, a day after the attack, the software manufacturers supplied the Army with the necessary updates to correct the error. They almost saved 28 lives. You know, the saddest word in the whole wide world is almost. And there's no more sad story about almost than the story of King Agrippa. I mean, we can't talk about almost and not talk about Agrippa, because we all know the story. In Acts chapter 25 and 26, Paul is making his defense to King Agrippa. In his address, as part of his defense, he basically gives Agrippa a sermon. And at the end, Agrippa has this to say in Acts chapter 26, verse 28. Then Agrippa said to Paul, "You almost persuade me to become a Christian." Now, we can take that a lot of different ways. We can take it to mean that Agrippa recognized that Paul was trying to convert Agrippa. Maybe that's the least sad explanation. But the most sad explanation is that Agrippa really thought, "I'm almost persuaded." Almost, but not quite. Actually, not at all. We don't know if King Agrippa ever took action, but if he never took that first step and he stayed almost persuaded, King Agrippa is most certainly altogether lost. I don't know the condition of your souls this morning, but I think you do. And if you've been thinking about giving your life to Christ, don't be almost persuaded. Don't give almost all of your life to God. Give all of your life to God and be altogether saved in baptism and the washing away of your sins. If there's something a congregation can do for you, let it be known as we stand and sing a closing number.